coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Love is a great god, to be revered in earth and heaven.
In Praise of Love, Plato's Symposium meets Bernstein's Serenade.
Love confers on us the greatest benefits. Above all, the principle by which we all should live the whole time.
Plato's Symposium is one of the most profound philosophical works ever written on the topic of love.
And Leonard Bernstein's Serenade is a gorgeous violin concerto inspired by the symposium.
Is it really possible to translate abstract philosophical arguments into music?
Bernstein didn't claim that this was a direct interpretation.
Our guest is Brandy Parisi from All Classical Portland Radio.
He clearly thought of this piece in a very, very personal way.
Finding the music in the symposium and the philosophy in the serenade.
In Praise of Love, coming up on Philosophy Talk.
This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the Skyview Concert Hall in Vancouver, Washington, home of the Vancouver Symphony, where later today, Anne Akiko Myers and the symphony will be performing.
Our thinking originates at Stanford University, Philosopher's Corner. That's where Ken teaches philosophy, and I taught philosophy for 40 years.
40 wonderful years, John. 40 memorable years. Welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk. Today, our topic, In Praise of Love. Plato's Symposium meets Bernstein's Serenade.
Plato's Symposium, Ken, is, you got to admit, one of the most memorable philosophical works ever written on the topic of love.
I certainly agree, John, and it's not just because of the philosophical content of the symposium, but also because of its style. It's an amazing work. The symposium is by turns hilarious, it's emotionally resonant, and every single line is philosophically deep. It's a fun and inspiring read.
Well, it certainly inspired Leonard Bernstein. In his Violin Concerto Serenade, Bernstein sets out to reproduce in music something of both the philosophical content and also the literary structure of Plato's Symposium.
Now, that's a tall order. The Symposium is an extraordinarily intricate and complicated work, really well crafted. It's a series of speeches. Each speech is spoken by a different character. Each of the speeches is in praise of erotic love. And each speaker has a distinctive personality, a distinctive style, and a distinctive philosophical outlook. It's an amazing thing.
Yeah, and you left out the most entertaining part.
Oh, you're thinking about the drinking, aren't
Absolutely.
You?
Absolutely. The assembled company wants to drink. They've actually been at this discussion for a whole day. They drank a lot the day before, so they don't want to drink so much today. To ensure that they'll drink less, they decide to temper their drinking with a little philosophy. I could have told them that's not going to work.
Yeah, because whenever you drink, you do more philosophy. If you do philosophy, you do more drink. But look, instead of trying to out-drink each other as they had the night before, they try to outdo each other in their praise of love. It's a kind of contest of who can praise love the most.
You know, they don't really succeed. By the time the final speaker, Alcibiades, comes in, they're all very drunk, and he's drunk when he arrives. And they commence drinking even more as he gives the final unexpected speech.
Now, Bernstein tries to capture this dynamic in his music. The Serenade is a series of musical movements. Each of the movements is offered in praise of some form of love. Each of the speeches is modeled on one or more speeches in Plato's Symposium, and the movements build on and correct each other in much the same way that, as the speeches do in the dialogue. And it's all done with a kind of joyfulness, not quite drunken, but a serious kind of joyfulness.
Well, you know, I grant you, Ken, it's a fine piece of music, but to be honest, if I hadn't read Bernstein's notes explaining what you just said, I would have no idea, just from listening to it, that it was modeled after the symposium or even that it had anything to do with love.
What's the point you're trying to make here, John?
Well, for example, some of the characters argue for the superiority of homosexual love over heterosexual love. Now, what is that argument supposed to sound like on a violin?
It sounds like you're doubting the musical powers of Bernstein. You don't think he could pull this off?
Well, nothing against Leonard Bernstein personally. I just think what he sets out to do is impossible.
Oh, come on. Impossible. Why would you say that? Music can do lots of stuff.
Music is one thing. Instrumental music in particular is one thing. Philosophical arguments are a different thing entirely. I mean, I admit, country and Western music can get pretty philosophical. Stand by your man. You got to know when to hold him and know when to fold him. But it's the voice that carries the philosophy, not the fiddle. Even a classical violin can't give you a philosophical argument.
John, you sound like Plato himself. He's one of my favorite philosophers. He's a grouch when it came to music. He actually wanted to banish all lyric poets, you know, music, harmony, rhythm, all that stuff. He wanted to banish it from his ideal republic. Philosophy, well, that's serious stuff. That's improving because it aims at the unadorned truth. It speaks to reason. Lyric poetry? Ugh. That's corrupting. It can't distinguish the true from the false. It speaks to the emotions rather than reason. It deals in mere appearance and illusion rather than reality. You sound like much of a grouch as Plato was.
Well, yeah, sure. Yada, yada, yada. Go on and on. You're not answering my point. How does a purely musical argument for the superiority of Platonic love go? I don't agree with Plato that music is corrupting or should be banished. I'm not saying that it's not an appropriate vehicle for a lot of things, but not for representing philosophical themes and arguments.
I don't share your skepticism, John. Look, Plato's philosophy, you'll admit this, it's full of artistry. The Symposium is a case in point. Why can't there be music that's full of philosophy?
Well, we're not going to settle this dispute with an abstract philosophical argument. We'll give your point a chance. We'll do some listening. We're going to have to see if we can hear the philosophy in Bernstein's music and the music in Plato's philosophy.
And to help us on that journey, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Shukin Kalantari, to take a deeper dive into Bernstein's serenade. She files this report.
In ancient Greece, the Symposium was a place for men to get together and drink all night. A forum for men of respected families to philosophize, plot, and debate. The Symposium is also the name of a philosophical text by Plato, in which seven ancient Greek philosophers debate the meaning of love. It's where we get the concept of Platonic love. Many in this symposium believed the highest form of love was between two men. But Socrates said the highest form of love is philosophy, literally the love of wisdom.
Think of the ecstasy you experience in the company of your beloved. Even this beauty is enough to make you oblivious of food and drink. What kind of ecstasy then will the man experience who lives in the company of absolute beauty itself? Pure, unmixed, and unadulterated with all the colors and flesh and rubbish of mortality. Absolute and alone.
A few thousand years later, in 1954, composer Leonard Bernstein wrote a concerto called Serenade, inspired by Plato's Symposium. Bernstein, famous for West Side Story, Candide, and so many others, had his own conflicts with love. He was married to a woman, but he loved men, pretty openly. Many believe Bernstein's concerto was his way of questioning the very meaning of love. Like violin virtuoso Anne Akiko Myers, she discovered Bernstein's Serenade while driving one day.
It was coming through the radio of my rental car. And I was completely enraptured when I heard what now I know as the fourth movement, or Agathon. It was so tender and lyrical and magical, and I had to stay in the car till the end of the performance to find out who wrote this.
Myers was hooked. She learned more about how Plato's Symposium inspired Bernstein to write the Serenade. And that inspired Myers to release her own Serenade, the Love Album.
I wanted to explore the different facets of love by also commissioning seven arrangers, just like Plato's seven philosophers who are debating love to write 10 new works.
Meyer says Bernstein was a passionate person, and that passion resonates throughout the serenade. Each movement is a different quality of love. Gentleness, conflict, drama.
It's so beautiful. There are moments of great tenderness. There's jazzy sections. The first movement is kind of statesman-like, with the violin starting completely buck naked. And it's so arresting because no other violin concerto starts off with a discussion, you know, about love in such a startling way.
Meyer says all the movements in Bernstein's serenade touch her in different ways. But it's the fourth movement, Agathon, the one she heard in her rental car years ago, that grabs her the most.
I think that the fourth movement really captures Leonard Bernstein's soul. It's so poetic and deep, and there's lots of conflict in there as well, with a big cadenza that I play, and you can almost feel Leonard Bernstein, you know, pounding his fists, like, what is this love? What is it? You know, what does it mean?
Thousands of years ago, men gathered at a symposium to drink wine and think deep thoughts. That symposium was a way for Plato to explore love through words, a way for Leonard Bernstein to explore love through music. And today, it's why Anna Kiko Myers tours the world, playing musical representations of love with roots in a room in ancient Greece. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shuka Kalantari.
Thank you, Shuka and Anne. I'm John Perry, along with my fellow philosopher from Stanford, Ken Taylor. We're coming to you tonight from Skyview Concert Hall in Vancouver, Washington.
And joining us now is the host of All Classical Portland. She also teaches philosophy at Portland Community College, so she's a jack of many trades. Please welcome to the Philosophy Talk stage, Brandi Parisi. Welcome, Brandi.
So, Brandi, now you're clearly highly versed in both music and philosophy, two demanding things that could fill up one's life. What first drew you to this combination?
Well, I started studying music as a child at about 8 or 9, and philosophy shortly thereafter. At about 13, 14, I discovered Buddhism. I studied music, though, in communications as an undergrad, and I started in radio when I was 17, and I loved radio, but I just wanted more. There was something that was missing. And so, like any reasonable person, I quit my job and went back to graduate school in philosophy.
That was a great lucrative move.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. But they've all combined along the way, and now I'm fortunate enough to do both.
Well, I'm glad this philosophy stuff is working out for you. Ken and I pointed out in the opening that Plato wanted to banish the lyric poets from his ideal republic. So why do you think he would think of Bernstein's composition?
I think that's a great question. Plato had a problem with all representative art because it takes us, he believed, further and further away from true knowledge, from the forms. And he says it just brings us down this chain where we're losing sight of what's real. And moreover, representative art, it causes us to have all these emotional feelings. And so he called it this divine madness, almost out of our heads. And he really had a problem with lyric poetry and with tragedy. Sometimes music gets a pass because music, at least in most cases, isn't directly representational. There are exceptions, like the flight of the bumblebee and things like that. But in this case, yeah, this is representational.
It's trying to represent Plato himself.
Exactly.
He'd probably be pissed off at Bernstein.
I suspect he would have, ironically, more of a problem this piece than
other
music.
Let me ask you a question. So how are we supposed to talk about love without feeling? Does he think, because one of the bad things about this lyric poetry and all that, it speaks to the emotion rather than reason. How are we supposed to talk about love without feeling?
Well, I think Plato's acknowledging that that's where we start, that we start from that subjective feeling part, but then we move to something higher, ideally. Look, it's not a coincidence. Plato is the most poetic and lyrical writer. He knows his audience.
He's a wonderful writer. He's a wonderful artist. So that really does make his rejection of lyric poetry kind of odd, I think.
Well, I mean, it's kind of odd. I think, to claim that love of an abstract object like the form of love is the highest form of erotic love.
Well, we'll get to that. That is an odd thing that the symposium argues. But I'll say this is Philosophy Talk. We're coming to you from the Skyview Concert Hall in Vancouver, Washington, home of the Vancouver Symphony. Our guest is Brandi Parisi from All Classic Portland Radio.
According to Plato, erotic love comes in many varieties. Some are base and unworthy of praise. Which is the highest form of erotic love and why? Could it really be platonic love, which cares not at all for the body and is concerned with only the abstract form of beauty itself?
Ascending Plato's ladder of love with music, philosophy, and questions from our live and erotic audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
The music of Anne Akiko Myers from her release Serenade, the Love Album, a little bit of Leonard Bernstein's Magic. And this is Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Brandi Parisi from All Classical Portland, and we're asking about love, in praise of love, where Plato's Symposium meets Bernstein's Serenade.
What is love? What makes a person worthy of love? Are some forms of love debasing? Is there a highest form of love? Join the discussion by stepping up to the microphones in front of the stage.
So, Brandi, John and I are philosophers, but and we're going to talk a lot of philosophy, but I want to start by, John said Bernstein's trying to do something impossible. I want to start by comparing what Plato's up to in the Symposium with what Bernstein's up to in the Serenade. Now, the Symposium gives us a series of delightfully vivid, but they're still abstract and complicated philosophical arguments. John says you can't do that in music. So is the Serenade pretending to be like a musical version of a series of arguments, or what is it about?
And there are discrete arguments in the Symposium also. So Bernstein didn't claim that this was a direct interpretation. What he said was, this is an impression after many readings. But what they do have in common is that Bernstein takes these themes, these melodic themes in the case of the music, and he builds on and takes away from them as he moves from movement to movement. But there are certain melodies that you'll hear played out in different kinds of ways throughout the entire piece. And we actually have a couple of excerpts from this. One excerpt, the first one we're going to hear, actually has just a tiny piece from the first, second, and fourth movement. So you can hear how he's manipulating this work, not just with the violin. He's also bringing in cello and viola and other string instruments.
So, okay, I think I get part of what you're saying. Because here, let's think about one of the things that happens in the Symposium. So, you know, they start out arguing about, each speaker takes a turn kind of praising love. The first kind of love is kind of this homosexual love between an older man and a younger boy, and why is it good, and why should the boy submit, and why should the older man do this, and it's about virtue and all this sort of stuff. And it's sort of shallow in a certain sense. I wouldn't quite say shallow. But then subsequent speeches, because like one of the subsequent speeches is, well, look, there's base love and there's higher love. And what's the difference between base love? So it's taking the same theme and it's correcting and building on. And a lot of the speeches are consistent with each other, but they get more and more complicated and deeper and deeper. And I can hear that in the music, right? That there's a theme. And then there's an articulation of the theme, and it gets deeper, and there's other voices coming in. And
absolutely. Even in the places where he has two different philosophers in the same movement, what Bernstein does is that he uses different tempo markings to let us know, okay, we have a change coming. So in the first movement, we start with the Phaedrus movement, and then we move into Pausanias. And he moves from a lento, a very soft kind of restrained movement, into this allegro movement, which is almost like lento's more more active, excitable brother. And so the two are having this conversation in that first movement.
And in the last movement, in the final movement, right, when Socrates and Diotima, however you say her name, are explaining what I guess is supposed to be the true nature of love, the most complicated speech of all. There's this interruption, right? And Alcibiades comes on the stage. Do we have a...
Absolutely, yeah. So this last movement, we have this section, like you said, with Socrates, and he's talking about these higher ascensions of different kinds of love, of philosophy. And then the drunk Alcibiades bursts in and says, "You're all wrong, and here's why." And I think we have an excerpt from that. That's cut 5. There he is.
There's Alcibiades, the drunk Alcibiades.
That's him.
Stumbling upon this part. Okay, but I want to ask you, okay, I get the kind of structural similarities. I get that Bernstein thought really hard about this composition. It's a beautiful, I've listened to it a ton of times in preparation. It is a beautiful, intricate piece of music. Just as the Symposium, which I've taught and read dozens of times, is a beautiful, intricate piece of philosophy. But let's step back a second. Plato's a philosopher. He's trying to move us through a sequence of thought and thought experiments and episodes of thinking and rediscovering and getting deeper and all this sort of stuff. What is Bernstein trying to accomplish?
Well, Bernstein, first of all, he doesn't even use the same order. He throws the section with Aristophanes. In the Symposium, there's actually this comic moment where Aristophanes has the hiccups. And so the doctor, Axiomachus, steps in and says, "Oh, let me go ahead and do this. You get some water. You can come in after." But Bernstein gives Aristophanes the second movement. What's kind of interesting, though, is that this fourth movement and the fifth speaker in the symposium is Agathon, who's this beautiful man who's also the host, by the way, of the party. They're celebrating a poetry contest that he's won. And he gives this very rhetorical speech that is lyrical and beautiful but doesn't have a lot of philosophical heft at all. But Bernstein gives the most beautiful music of the entire piece to this.
That's true, but that's, I think, John, you want to get in there?
Yeah. No, go ahead and finish this thought. And I'll
no, that's true, because I don't want to diss Bernstein.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a great piece of music, but I actually think he misread the Symposium.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
You know, he thinks Agathon is the culmination of the argument, but actually Socrates proceeds to take Agathon apart. He demolishes Agathon. And he's because and let's do a little philosophy, because Agathon is like, love is beautiful, love is this highest thing, blah blah blah, and it's a beautiful oration in praise of this thing which is the most beautiful. But Socrates has a simple kind of refutation of that. Look, we seek beauty, we seek love, but wait a minute, that means we don't have it, because you don't seek what you don't seek what you have, so love is a seeker after the beautiful. It's not the beautiful itself, it's a seeker. But the seeker is needy. The seeking is born of need and lack. And so love both lacks, and so that's a little bit of a paradox. And Agathon has nothing to say.
And in fact, it's a pretty quick refutation. And that's the exact, you're right. How can something that already has love also desire love?
Yeah.
And I think Agathon also says, you know, love is a god that is the youngest god.
Right.
And Socrates basically says, where do you get that? I mean, in no small part, Socrates is easily the oldest man in the room. So he probably had a good reason to be a little bothered by that.
So John, you want to
hear? Well, a little bit different angle here. But, you know, a lot of people... Maybe some people in the audience, people who listen to this when it's on the radio, they're not going to have read Plato's Symposium. And I think we ought to give them a little bit of a warning. Kenneth said it's beautiful and wonderful and profound, and the music is beautiful and wonderful and profound, and they're going to sit down and read this. A lot of it sounds like a brief for molesting teenagers.
That's true.
I mean, sure, eventually Socrates argues that what you really ought to be gaga about is an abstract object, the form of love. But on the way, a lot of nice is said about, you know, how young boys and old men ought to go together. Am I being too critical of the Greeks or the Greek philosophers? Am I misunderstanding what they're telling me here?
Whether you're being too critical or not, I think you're accurate. Pausanias, he foreshadows Socrates, and he starts to draw these dualities, first between the beloved and the lover, but then also between these two different kinds of love, what he called the base love, that's the sexual gratification love, and he is pretty clear. That's the love that we have with women, and the love that we have with young men, and they do specify, we're not talking about little boys, but they say he has to at least have his first beard. That's
first,
also
first beard. I think first I think you go to jail for first beard stuff in America.
Do.
Let's do be fair to them. This relationship between the older man and the younger boy was supposed to be like a teacher-student relationship. And the older man was supposed to be seeing to the virtue of the younger man. And the younger man should not put himself in the hands of any older man who did not see to his virtue. So, and it was a view that love is morally improving because in the presence of the lover, one becomes one's better self, right? So the lover, and the lover cares for you in a way that nobody else does, right? There are all these beautiful metaphors of how the lover cares for the beloved. So it wasn't just lust. I mean, lust for the body. It was about turning the other toward virtue and being able to turn the other toward virtue. Only the wiser could turn the lesser toward virtue.
Yeah,
so
you sound like a really good defense lawyer for some high school biology teacher that got in a little bit of trouble.
Well, there is the section, though, in the Socrates that I think plays on that, in the early part of the Socrates, where he's gone to see Diotima, the philosopher, and she's explained that we're all pregnant, and we're pregnant with the desire for immortality, and some of us are pregnant with the desire for immortality through children, and those are people who have intercourse with women, and some of us are pregnant with ideas, and that comes out through these mentor relationships with young men,
yeah.
And that's a better kind of immortality.
That's what they claim. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about In Praise of Love, where Bernstein Serenade meets Plato Symposium, and we're in front of a live audience in Vancouver, Washington, and we've got questions from that live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Matt. Tell us who you are, first name, no last names, and then what your comment or question is.
My name is Sandra, and you did say that they were all men in this symposium, and is philosophy all men? Because I think the greatest love is a mother for her child, and that's platonic, but that's... It just seems like that's much more important than any other love.
Well, there's one thing we're talking about here in the symposium. It's about eros, erotic love. There are many forms of love that are not erotic love, but this is specifically about eros, the goddess of love.
Yeah.
It doesn't deny those other forms of love, but it's not a form of eros.
Yeah, well, it can't be platonic then.
If love for this abstract object turns out to qualify, I would think a mother's love qualifies. I'm with our questioner.
But you say it can't be platonic. One thing you have to understand about Socrates is represented in the symposium by Plato. I don't know what Plato believes, but Socrates, as represented in the symposium by Plato, believes that this thing, platonic love, is actually the highest form of erotic love. That erotic love, when carried to his logical conclusion, leads to platonic love. Do I have that right?
I agree. I think also a little bit of an explainer about the ascent that happens in the Socrates section. So Socrates has gone to see this woman, Diotima, and he says, she's taught me about what real love is, the kind of love you can hang your hat on. So just like everything in the world is temporary and is going to fall away or die if it's alive, those are things that don't give us any information about true knowledge, according to Plato. True knowledge comes from the forms, and when we are pursuing that kind of knowledge, we are pursuing something higher and more important. At the same time, he says, look at these relationships between people. We believe they're permanent. We act like my beloved is never going to change, but of course we know that's not true. And ultimately, if I can decide to move in a different direction and move instead of love for a body to realizing I'm thinking of love for all bodies and the beauty in bodies and then the love for beauty itself and then the pursuit of these higher kinds of forms, I'm ascending to something different, some other kind of pursuit in which I'm not wrapped up with all of the ugliness of having individual erotic relationships with the other.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir. What's your comment? Where are you from and what's your comment or question?
My name is Dustin, and I'm from Mount Angel Seminary. I'm a philosophy major. And I have a question. You talk about the ascent that happens throughout the symposium. I would like to hear your take on what the role of Alcibiades is, why he crashes the party. Yeah. Like, what is, we get this ascent, and then there's this.
Yeah, the Alcibiades, give you a little background. So Alcibiades was a student of Socrates, and he was one of the greatest generals of Athens. And at a point after the symposium took place in the history of, supposedly took place, Alcibiades betrayed Athens. He betrayed Athens to the Spartans. Yeah, and that was really bad. Alcibiades was Socrates was put to death for corrupting the youth. Exhibit A for Socrates corrupting the youth was Alcibiades. He was the example. So why is he in the symposium? And why does he come in? Why is he the last thing in the symposium?
Why he's the last thing is the most curious part, because Plato typically gives us the last philosopher or the last word to be the takeaway, right? So he gives us Socrates, and then Alcibiades bursts in drunk and says, I was rejected by him. And he's jealous, and he's drunk, and he's furious. And he says, all of you talking about love in this universal way, that's not the truth. True love is this subjective thing that we all have, that we hurt, and we're angry, and we're jealous.
Because Alcibiades loves Socrates. And he says, you can't come in and drink with us, they say, unless you give a speech. And we're talking about love. He says, I'm not going to give a speech about love. I'm going to give a speech about Socrates. And he gives this amazing speech about Socrates, who is the object of his love. And it's really puzzling, exactly. Scholars have bent their brains over this quite a lot.
He's also got a garland on his head of ivy and violets, which some have said maybe he's Dionysus. Maybe he's representing this kind of primal chaos.
You could see him as, so there is this argument that we alluded to. I want to talk a little bit more about that, that his platonic love is the highest form of love. You could see Alcibiades as the refutation of that in concrete embodiment. But we'll take that up after the break, and I'll remind you that you are listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about Plato's Symposium, Bernstein's Serenade, and the philosophy of love. Our guest is Brandi Parisi, a host at All Classical Portland Radio.
Plato thought the highest form of love, the highest form of erotic love, is so-called platonic love. The object of platonic love is not this or that body or even this or that person, but the unchanging form of beauty itself. Could that possibly be right as an understanding of erotic love? Did Bernstein agree with this weird view of Plato's? What do you think?
We're coming to you from Skyview Concert Hall in Vancouver, Washington. We'll take more questions from our live and erotic audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
That's music from Anne Akiko Myers, a bit of her interpretation from Bernstein's Serenade. It's from her album, Serenade, the love album. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. Our guest is Brandi Parisi, who teaches philosophy at Portland Community College and hosts a radio show on All Classical Portland Radio. And we're thinking about where Plato's Symposium meets Bernstein's Serenade in Praise of Love, and we have a question from our audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Hi, my name's Chris. I'm from Vancouver. It seems like we've been having our own discussion in this nation as a whole about what love means and what kind of love is acceptable. What do you think Plato would have to say if he were to chime in on our current discussion?
Wow, that's a good question, Brandi. I'm going to turn that one over to you, since I have no idea.
I do think that there's something running through the entire symposium about what bodies, if we're going to be talking about love between people, before the ascent, before the ladder, what bodies and what genders are worthy of love. It does seem to say, at least in several sections, that for Socrates and for a couple of the philosophers, this higher form of love has to do with the higher forms of ideals, at least initially, that we receive from other people and that we gain through these lifelong relationships between boys and men.
So if Plato were writing this today and came to me for a little editorial advice, I would say, forget that Alcibiades, have Xantippa come in and break up. That's
his
Socrates' wife.
Yeah.
Long-suffering wife who I don't... And put these guys straight.
There's one speech that we haven't talked about. And Bernstein gives this kind of... doesn't give it enough heft. That's the Aristophanes, right? Because I think that's actually the most beautiful and convincing part of the symposium, myself, because he's got this creation myth that explains all forms of bodily love, at least. In the beginning, there were these creatures. They had two heads and two backs and two sets of genitalia, and they rolled around, and they were really powerful, and the gods got really pissed off at them, and he split them in half. Now, some of the creatures were male-male, others were female-female, some were male-female. And the reason there are these different forms of love is because it's the original wound. We were torn asunder from our other half, and we're continually in search of our other half.
So Plato would have been up to date in one sense, namely that you're born gay. It doesn't take someone like Socrates to talk you into it.
Aristophanes would think that. Actually, Socrates rejects that theory. He said there is this theory that what we're searching for in searching for love is our other half. But see, that's very bodily, very particular. There is a particular person who completes you because you're by your nature incomplete, and you have this hunger for the other, and that's what love is. I think that's a beautiful theory of love, but Socrates thinks it's completely mistaken.
Well, I know that when I teach the symposium, this is the section that students really respond to because it is so sweet, this idea that what love is just our constant looking for our other half that at some point we were just separated from. And it is a lovely idea.
And it's something about, but see, it's a lovely idea because it says the need for love is born of a wound. He calls it the original wound, that we are by nature incomplete beings and we need this completion. I think that's a beautiful thought. We've got another question. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Hi, my name is Ibrahim, and I'm a psychologist here in the community. My question is about Alcibiades' entrance at the end. I'm wondering if it has something to do with kind of the forbidden element of romance, like you see in Tristan and Isolde, where there's something unattainable and Alcibiades cannot attain Socrates' love. So a sort of element of unattainability and also an element of being like kind of stolen by love, that it just happens, it comes out of nowhere, it's unexpected, it's unpredictable. So I'm wondering if you have anything to say about these elements of kind of love being unexpected and love being kind of unattainable, something that you can't really reach.
The one thing that comes through so much with Socrates is how remote and above things he is. We're told that he can drink and not get drunk, that he doesn't get hangovers. We're told that he can go without sleep and then go and lecture and talk and have dialogue in Athens the next day and not worry about it. That in some ways he is removed from the body, that this physicality doesn't burden him anymore. And in fact, Alcibiades refers to him as a statue that has all these little tiny statues inside. And he also talks about, Ken, you and I have been talking about how he says, Socrates shames me. He makes me not want to be a politician, and I do want to be a politician, and when I'm not in his sight, I'm failing his vision of what I can be, and this is awful, and I feel like I'm a slave to this thing.
It is very clear that Alcibiades is made miserable by Socrates.
Yes.
And made miserable by his love for Socrates, and that's part of the reason. But I want to transition to something else. We're going to ask you what Bernstein thought of what looks like the central argument, except for the possible refutation by Alcibiades, that Platonic love is the highest form of love. You think Bernstein gave any credence to that? I mean, would he have believed that?
So the one nice thing that we have right now is a set of letters that were just published a couple of years ago. We don't even really have to speculate. The one thing about Bernstein is that he loved people. In the 1930s, he wrote to one of his fellow students at Harvard, and he says, I can't bear to go for even an hour without being around people. So I don't think this kind of, he was never going to be on the ladder.
Yeah, but tell me about his Anne talked about his relationship to his wife, and you talked about how he was married, but he loved men, and he had,
And he did love his wife, Felicia, as well. And one of these other letters is from her. And she says in this letter, I know you're homosexual, and I've accepted that this will probably never change. And she said, our marriage is a marriage not of passion, but of tenderness and of mutual respect. And that seemed to work for them for a long time. And he wrote about how he loved her very, very much, and he adored his children, but he still left her in 1976.
Now, see, that's not the full achievement of platonic love, because it's not about the idea of beauty, but it's on that ladder.
It is a kind
of platonic
love.
It is definitely a step on that ladder. When you love the other person, not as an object of lust, but with this utter respect that sees the beauty in them and loves the beauty in them.
And when she became sick, she got cancer, he came back to take care of her. He definitely, that's probably the closest he came to the ideal of platonic love.
Isn't there a song about that, climbing Plato's ladder? Is that is that an early version of putting the symposium to music, or do I have it wrong?
Sounds about right.
Yeah, we probably got time for one last question. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
I'm Rod Evenson from rural Clackamas County, south of here. I'm thinking of C.S. Lewis's essay on the four loves. I know we've left out the love between a man and his dog, and something you don't bring up at weddings, I guess. But I'm wondering if you know of that and can make some comparison here with that essay.
Do you know C.S. Lewis?
I know C.S. Lewis, but I don't know that.
Yeah,
that
I don't know that. I don't know that.
What are the four loves?
Storge, philia, can I remember them all? Eros and agape.
Agape.
Well, I don't think there's any agape in the Greeks.
No.
In the ancient Greeks, but
give me a hint. What's agape?
Maybe Zeus has agape for the world, because he sees all the. But Plato, I don't know enough about Plato to know what he would think of exactly about those things. Okay, but I'm going to give you a chance to give us a closing thought here, I mean, about this piece of music, about the symposium, about philosophy and music together. I mean, John started out thinking, you can't do philosophy through music, but does Bernstein give the lie to that?
I think Bernstein gives extraordinary voice to these ancient voices. You and I both agree that we probably read the symposium quite a bit differently in the parts that we think are important, both to us and to Plato, and to what it means in our time. But he found that part the most moving. I have no doubt that he also had this kind of wonderful erotic love with individuals, and also approached maybe something like platonic love with his wife.
You know what really strikes me is how carefully he constructed this thing.
Yes.
And how much it's modeled on the symposium. And you should.
Absolutely. One other quick mention also. Not just the main melodic line that we've been talking about, he also incorporated little pieces that he had written over the years for friends and family, for anniversaries and birthdays, and he called these piano pieces the anniversary pieces. These are also they're included in the symposium as well. He clearly thought of this piece in a very, very personal way.
So, Brandy, this has been a great conversation. I could talk to you for hours more, but unfortunately, we can't do that. So I'm going to thank you for joining
us. Thank you so much for having me.
Our guest has been Brandy Parisi. She's a radio host at All Classical Portland and a philosophy instructor at Portland Community College. John, I think this was a great conversation. I wonder if you're having any erotic thoughts now.
Well, erotic thoughts and I go together like, I don't know, peaches and cream, I guess. But, you know, I really think philosophically the symposium's pretty weak. It's got two big flaws, two things that Plato understands love of. And they're both very male, right? There's this kind of erotic, in the ordinary sense, of love. And then there's love of abstract objects. But to me, the heart of love, as one of our questioners said, is love of a mother for her children. And that's where Aristophanes' myth comes from. Male and female, we are ripped out of, a woman, and that's fundamental love. And in humans have somehow managed to get the male involved in this, sometimes in a more than carnal and erotic way. Still the exception that proves the rule. Plato missed the essence of what he was talking about, my humble opinion.
Yeah, if we had another hour, I would talk you out of that view, but I can't. But this conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner on our online community of thinkers, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo. I think, therefore I blog. And you too can become a partner in that community by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
Now, what would Plato, and Leonard Bernstein for that matter, make of our fast-talking guy, Ian Scholes? He's the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, a symposium is a drinking party, but Plato's symposium doesn't even start with that. It starts with a guy, one of Socrates' students, walking down the street a few years after the party. He runs into another guy who heard from these other guys that the first guy knows all about Socrates at Agathon's big party. Let's call him Paul. Paul says he wasn't there, but Tim, an older student of Socrates, was, and Tim told Paul all about it. So the two of them go walking down the street, Paul, who wasn't at the party, telling the story in the words of Tim, who was at the party, and the whole thing written down by Plato, who wasn't at the party, a few years later. Again, it's quite a memorable party, and we aren't even there yet. History, literature, movies, full of parties we just can't let go. Woodstock, Burning Man, VE Day, the Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, The Last Supper, hello. Prince Harry in Las Vegas, when Andrew Jackson threw an inaugural open house at the White House, 20,000 people showed up. So many he had to escape out the window. Many parties do not end well. Madame Bovary's wedding, The Mask of the Red Death, which starts in dancing, ends in plague. The party of Pooh, that was sweet. Mrs. Danvers tricks the new wife into wearing the first wife's dress at the ball in Rebecca, that was not sweet. The ball in Mansfield Park, the cocktail party in All About Eve, the party in Mrs. Dalloway, the weekend dinner party in Rules of the Game, which does not end well. The many weekend parties attended by Hercule Poirot, which begin with bridge and ended murder, am I right? Truman Capote's black and white ball at the Plaza in 1965 to celebrate the publication of In Cold Blood, his triumph and his swan song. Nicholas and Alexandra had a ball, and they came to a bad end. The Christmas party in Less Than Zero, the parties in The Great Gatsby. There's the party in Macbeth, where the ghost of Banquo shows up. Awkward. There's the party in Alice in Wonderland, Flamingo Croquet, remember? Bilbo Baggins' 71st birthday, the party in the woods with the Ewoks. And, of course, the never-ending dinner party and the discreet charm of the bourgeoisie where they never get to eat. Much better luck in the Satyricon. Tamalchio's dinner has 12 courses, including a hog stuffed with sausages. The carving of the meat is choreographed in time to music. And Andrew Jackson, again, you don't think of him as a party animal, but in 1835, somebody gave the president a 1,400-pound wheel of cheese. It fermented for a year, and Jackson took out an ad inviting the country to help him eat it. On Cheese Day, more than 10,000 people showed up. It was said that you could smell cheese a half mile in every direction, and it took the crowd 2 hours to finish it off. Then there are the teen parties, 16 candles, the epic party in Days That Confuse. Remember Matthew McConaughey bought the beer? The prom in Carrie. Wrapping things up, there's the toga party in Animal House, which inspired a generation to have drunken yet bland costume parties. Your costume is a sheet. Now that's just wrong. Which brings us back to the symposium, which may have been the original toga party. I assume they were wearing togas. Alcibiades shows up drunk with Dionysian garlands around his head. What else would he be wearing, a tuxedo? And he chides Socrates for not having sex with him. And then things fall apart. Sounds like a great party. Until only Socrates is left standing, because he never gets drunk ever, and he never gets cold or tired, and he's the wisest man living. So Plato says, wise fellow, but not much fun at parties. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2015.
Our executive producer is David Demarest. Special thanks to Igor Shachman, Steve Bass, Dan Oliva, the Vancouver Symphony Orchestra, and Maestro Salvador Brotons.
And our partners, OPB and All Classical Portland Radio.
Also, Sean Pittman, Brent Rogers, Ron Christopher, and our philosophers of time, Courtney and Michael.
And don't forget Joel Groves, Doug Purdy, Zach DeHart, and Jim Stanek.
Our program is produced by the one and only Devin Strolovich, Laura McGuire, the brilliant Laura McGuire is our director of research, and Dave Millar is our director of marketing.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and the partners of our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW, Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking. Thank you.